Hannah Murray on TRE in the afternoon.
Joining us on the line now is David G. Smith. He's a professor in the John Hopkins Carey Business School and co-founder of the Gender and Work Initiative Centre at JHU. He's also the co-author of Fair Share, How Men and Women Can Create a More Equitable Workplace Together. The book addresses the gender fairness aspiration execution gap through gender collaboration and inclusive leadership as the keys to everyone getting their fair share, both at work and at home. Most thoughtful leaders aspire to more fairness and better inclusion around gender. They just don't know what to do. Fair Share shows organizations how to make it happen. Welcome to the show, David.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. So tell me where your interest in this subject came from and how long you've been working on it.
So my co-author, Brad Johnson, and I have been on this journey for the last 15 years. And actually, this is the third book and what we think is the trilogy around this idea of kind of gender allyship. And Brad and I got our start actually from the military. We were both prior military officers. We taught at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland. And while we were there, we had this, you know, this connection in terms of our research and understanding the fact that there were so many of these inequities in the workplace and challenges in lack of access to all sorts of resources and barriers put up in front of people in different ways. And the solutions often were to create a program or something that was really designed to, in many ways, to help women to become better leaders. And so these were leader development programs or women's mentoring programs, but it often sent this unintended message to men that they didn't belong or there wasn't a place for them or there wasn't a role or function. And so they didn't engage in the solution. There was no collaboration, right? It was really about women. And sometimes it even got into the point of trying to fix women when women didn't need to be fixed. We really needed to work together to change some of the system, the practices that we have that weren't working for any of us. And so Brad and I started our work in focusing on mentoring and career developmental relationships and how can we become better at engaging men and becoming part of that solution. And that was our first book, Athena Rising. That came out in 2016. You probably remember about a year later in 2017, Me Too went widespread around the world. And it really changed the conversation we were having, and not just about mentoring, but hey, let's talk about how do we just show up in the workplace and the kinds of relationships that we have in the workplace and being collegial, working together and collaborative and supportive of each other. And really, how do we show up as allies for each other? And that led to the research we did for our second book, Good Guys, which came out in 2020 during the pandemic. Crazy time to launch a book, right? And, you know, one of the things we talked about in Good Guys at the end of the book, the third part of the book, was really about this idea of systemic allyship. And what we were really talking about was getting past some of the interpersonal relational aspects of what we do in terms of how we behave in the workplace, but more about how do we change some of the practices that we have that are causing some of the things like a wage gap, you know, in terms of how we're paid equally, or maybe it's a lack of representation in senior leadership positions in a lot of places where men tend to be at the top of the pyramid more than women do. And so how do we change the practices that are leading us down that path to getting there? And that's really about changing a lot of the structure that happens within the workplace. And that's our new book, Fair Share. And so we're excited to launch and to talk about this approach to how we can begin to change the workplace, to structure it in a way that works for women and for men, and understanding the benefits that are there for both of them in different ways. And then also for the organization itself becomes more efficient, higher level performance. And then, of course, that affects the bottom line.
I have to say, it's interesting looking at this subject that a book that's been written about gender equality, particularly in the workplace, written by men. I've interviewed a lot of women who are very passionate about this subject for obvious reasons, because it seems to, in general, work situations and pay gaps and things like that tend to favour the men over the women. So it's normally the women that are writing these books. So have you had any backlash being men writing it, or are women really happy and excited that you're exploring this subject?
Yeah. And so for your listeners out there, if you saw Brad Johnson and myself, we kind of epitomize that whole majority person, that majority male, right? Being white, older men. And so we do get a lot of questions about maybe not backlash, but questions and curiosity around why are you writing and talking about these topics? And I think that's a great question. And that not just us, but most men ought to be ready to answer that question as well. And it's one of the ones that we think is so important that we talk about our why. Why is this important to us? What's our purpose? Why is gender equity something that's on our mind and we're talking about? And it was so important that we put it in the beginning, the foreword of our second book, Good Guys, because we think that all men should really begin to understand and really be able to communicate that to their audiences out there. And so for both Brad and I, we both have a personal connection to this work. And so for me, it was my partner, my wife. We both had parallel military careers as our first careers. And I think early on, we had a lot of conversations about the way we were treated in the workplace and the things that she was asked or told that I never did, right? About, hey, Dave, maybe you should smile more. Not something I ever heard, right? But something Wow. that she heard all the time, right? And also not just the kind of this interpersonal piece about how we're perceived in the workplace, but also the fact that perception extends into the fact that a lot of the resources that came to me very easily in terms of career development, of finding mentors, finding sponsors, people who are there to talk about me, support me, provide me opportunities, even when I wasn't in the room, was hard for her to find, really challenging. And so as I began to look into my own workplace and talk to my female colleagues about this, I realized that this was not just a one-off, right? There were a lot of women experiencing these things. They were much more, in terms of how the organization looked at women and treated women. And again, military, a very majority male, long-standing traditional organization out there, but we could do better. And again, and we saw that over the course of many decades of gender integration happening across the U.S. military, and then beginning to look at it beyond the military and look at other professions, look at other industries and sectors out there, and that there's a lot of these same issues going on across our different organizations today. And so that's where we started, was around that personal. But I think we often hear that many men also think of it as part of their personal identity, part of their leadership brand of who they are as leaders, of thinking about the moral case of taking care of people, taking care of their organization, of doing what's right for people, doing what's right for their organization. And again, if it gets us to higher performance, that's the right thing to do for business generally. And again, if we can do that by taking care of our people and treating them fairly and equally, even better.
Yeah. There's also a lot of disparities when it comes to, and it can vary in different countries, I know, but when it comes to getting parental leave and time off work to look after children, it's much more in favor in general, depending on the country, of the woman. The woman will always get more time than the man, which makes it difficult if you have a woman that wants to follow her career and the man that's quite happy to be a stay-at-home father and look after the children, which should be perfectly fine for that to happen. But it's not always as easy.
No, it's often not nearly as easy. And that's one of the challenges. We talk about the workplace being broken. This is part of it, a large part of it. It's these gender norms around particular roles and seeing that, you know, these assumptions that women are somehow innately the, you know, better caregivers than men are, or men are innately better breadwinners than women are. And that's not the case. And the reality is that today, most of us are in dual earner, dual career families. Why? Because we need two paychecks to get by, to live the life that we want to live, and sometimes just to pay the bills, get through the day at the end of the week. And so we need that. Those are the structures of the families that we live in. We are two breadwinners. We both need to be caregivers at the same time. Yet the reality is that many of us are penalized, and men at the same time trying to, as you mentioned, step into their caregiving roles. They're often not structured that way. And it's really easy for women, right? Because we see them as caregivers in the workplace, and we're going to make flex work available. We're going to make it's okay for them to take maternity leave, right? Those are all expected things, and they don't get penalized more. They're already penalized at a very high level by reducing their pay because they're seen that way. But when men step in to try to do those things, to use flex work, to use their paternity leave, they're going to get penalized. They're going to face that backlash. And that's true today. And we see that happening all across the world. It's not just in the United States. We just saw it in World Cup soccer, right? Just the other day with Jeremy Doku, you know, who's going to get to face the U.S. here coming up soon in a match tonight. Right? That he to take paternity leave, he was chastised publicly across the world in a lot of different places, different people. Of course, that was somewhat corrected. I think, you know, the backlash got some backlash to it. But still, it just goes to show you that these are widely held beliefs that, again, are well entrenched and ingrained, and that we've got to take a step in lots of different ways at both a country or national level is one way to do that. Certainly within our organizations, I think there's an opportunity right there on the day-to-day basis, working with the people that we work with every day to really change the culture and shift that at the grassroots level too.
Yeah. Are companies reliant on what is law? I mean, it's all very well for a company to say, no, mm-hmm. I want to give paternal leave for the father and make sure he's looked after. But if the law doesn't allow that, then that must be really difficult, even if the company wants to be different.
It can be, because they're going against the grain there. And I think the other thing that makes it even more challenging is within the law is also tax code. And sometimes tax code and regulation doesn't give you the benefits, doesn't make it worthwhile to a company financially to do some of these things. They don't reward companies, in other words, for doing that from a tax code perspective or regulation. And so you are going a little bit against the grain and stepping out there. But again, I think this also creates competition amongst our the different companies that are within our sector, within our trades. And so thinking about competitors doing at the same time, we can use that as a competitive advantage. And one of the things that I certainly see this within the U.S. and some other countries that don't have some of these great paid leave laws that are out there, these companies use it as that competitive advantage. They don't necessarily want to see a national level law put in place because it takes away the competitive advantage if they're offering some of these benefits already to their people.
Yeah. So who would you say you've written the book for? Have you written it for people who are employees or employers or both?
For both, and really focusing kind of at the senior leadership levels, but all the way down to frontline managers. And I think that's one of the things that I hope that a lot of frontline managers read the book, because we're there, we really emphasize, there's a whole chapter there that talks about how do we help frontline managers do the job of implementing a lot of these great policies that their employers have created, but they haven't necessarily been trained or educated or given the tools to be able to do it properly. And I think that's one of the challenges that a lot of managers are facing today and companies are facing, is they feel like they're creating great policy, but they're not seeing the results. They're not seeing the impact that they were looking for because it's not being implemented in the way that they wanted. Managers don't feel like they have the tools to be able to, what do I do with this paid leave? What do I do with these flexible work arrangements? How can I restructure the way that my team operates in a way that works for the organization? At the same time, I'm taking care of my people and doing what, again, my company wants me to do from a policy perspective.
Do you think things have got better? Are we moving in the right direction in terms of gender equality in the workplace?
I think certainly the last year and a half have certainly been challenging, and we've seen some stagnation and maybe even some, we've gone backwards in a few places out there, but there are lots of great examples of individual companies and organizations and countries that are doing great work. And again, that was one of the things that we were trying to highlight, is take a look at what the innovative practices look like that people are doing in different sectors, different size companies, because it's not a one size fits all. What I can do in a large global corporation is very different than what I can do in a small business, right? But the small businesses, again, they're very versatile. They're more agile because they are small. They don't have to deal with a lot of the other challenges that a global corporation has to deal with different laws and different code and different in different countries out there. And so, again, it's not a one size fits all, but looking at what do best practices look like in all the different areas so that, again, a company or a leader, they can look at what do I want to work on first and go in there and see how they can take that practice and adapt it to their own company.
And it's being informed, isn't it, with the information, either as somebody running a company, as you say, looking at the competition and seeing what other companies are doing, but also as an employee, be informed, have the information so you can go to your employer and say, look, this is what's happening here. I should be able to get that where we are or whatever.
Yeah, and there were lots of great examples of that where, you know, looking at companies where employees would reach out and they had an idea, right? And it was just getting somebody within the company leadership to think about it. For example, in Australia, we had a great example from Michael Ray, one of our colleagues down there. He was working with an automotive company and he's just talking to the employees and they say, hey, you know, one of the things that we as men, this was an automotive company, right? Majority male group. We as men would like to be able to do as fathers would be able to, we could just do one thing like pick up the kids or drop off the kids, one or the other during the day when it comes to school and daycare and things like that. That would make a huge difference in terms of our everyday lives out there. We could just do that one thing, but we can't because of the way our workday, our shifts are structured. And so they took this one 8-hour shift and they broke it up and they created two 10-hour shifts where each of the, so half the group could have a pickup and half the group could have a drop off and they'd overlap in a part of the day, but each one got that, right? And so here was a great idea that somebody at that level, at the low level had, they just couldn't get senior leadership to listen. And Michael brought that to them and said, look, you could just do it this way. And everybody'd be happy, and they were. And so again, we see a lot of that information flow being really important. The other piece around that I think this reminds me of as well is around transparency. And one of the keys from a caregiving perspective, and again, this gets to a shifting dynamic in our workforce we have today around an aging workforce. And again, we're getting older. We're working much longer. People are living much longer. So that's creating all sorts of other care, elder care opportunities and again, challenges for our people. But our employers, in many cases, don't understand what that population looks like. They don't necessarily know who their caregivers are. They don't know what their needs are. They don't know if they're being met. Are they having challenges that are really holding them back from a performance perspective? And they're afraid to ask because they're afraid of being sued or having a litigation brought against them in some way of being saying that they're being discriminated against. And employees don't want to divulge that information either. I'm afraid that if I divulge it to my employer, that somehow I might be discriminated against. I might have that promotion or that opportunity withheld from me. And so you got employees who don't want to share and employers who don't want to ask. And we have this gap because of the transparency. And we've really got to learn how do we close that gap? Because so many of our employees today in the workforce, over 70% at any one time, identify as a caregiver in the workforce. Employers don't necessarily know that. And most of us, right, almost 50% of us today identify as sandwich generation. This is the generation that is caring for children under the age of 18 and probably for aging parents over the age of 65 today. And so we have a lot of challenges when it comes to care and caregiving, and we need all of us, men and women, to be able to have policies that allow us to do that. At the same time, we still need to work. Yeah. We still need the paycheck. We got to be there, and employers need us to be there as well.
Yeah, I think it's transparency is a big thing. Have those conversations. If you need to leave during the day to pick a child up or to look after a parent and you want that to be a regular part of your day, be reasonable. You know, if you expect your employer to allow that to happen, what are you going to give them in return? Can you start work a bit earlier or leave work a bit later? So it's not that you're getting something from them for free and still earning the same amount of money. If you want the same amount of money, you need to ensure you're giving something back. So it's just having those conversations, I think, being transparent about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And not only with the employees, but this is, goes back to the managers and having, giving the managers the autonomy to be able to manage their workforce, their employees, and do that in a way that works for them, and understanding, because they know what their needs are. They know exactly what people need at that level. And so if they need time off or they need some flexibility during part of the day, could we have core work hours, for example, or do we work maybe a 4-day work week and we work longer hours during the 4 days and it helps by having an extra day off? Or again, there's a lot of different ways to restructure the work. It doesn't have to be an all or nothing. And again, as you said, I think employees understand that they want to work. They want the paycheck. They want to do good work. They want their employer to be satisfied and happy with the level of the work that they're doing. It's not like people are looking for a freebie out there. They understand that if I get one thing, I'm going to have to give somewhere else. And so how do we begin to do that? And that's where, again, the key linchpin there is that frontline manager who's doing the implementation every day.
I think it's amazing how so many more people are working from home now, either one or 2 days a week or full time. And that, I'm sure, has been since the pandemic. A lot of people were forced to work from home. And people have said since, well, I've been working really well at home. Can I continue to do that? And obviously, it depends on the company. It depends on the boss. It depends on the type of work. But that has allowed a lot of people to be more flexible, I guess, in their working hours. So that's always worth subject worth talking about if it works for your company.
Oh, absolutely. And we certainly see that in the data too, that, you know, pre-COVID, we were at something less than 10% of the workforce was working from home or remotely, at some part of the week. But today we've kind of reset and we see this new baseline that's about three times that, over 25% of the workforce is working from home at some point during the week out there. And even over the last, again, over the last year or so, we've seen a trend recently reported last month in the U.S., a trend toward increasing work from home. And again, I think we're seeing that employers are beginning to recognize that, you know, in many ways, they weren't necessarily comfortable with the work from home and the whole trust aspect of trusting their employees, but beginning to recognize that their employees need this and want this, and they're more they're more efficient, they're more effective, they get the higher levels of performance. Hiring is easier. They're having to increase the number of job ads out there today that have work from home opportunities as part of the structure of the job. We saw that in research last year where there was an increase in job ads that had those in it. And now we're seeing this year the number of people who are actually working from home are higher. So we're seeing a little bit of an increase back. I don't know how much, it would be interesting to see how much further that goes in terms of balancing that with some of these return to office mandates that we've seen in the press quite a bit.
Yeah. As you say, as long as the work's being done and that can be proved, then it shouldn't really make much difference.
No. And again, I think people want to do the work. And as we begin to change the way we evaluate work, and it's not so much about presenteeism or FaceTime of being, you know, seeing you here in the office every day, but it is about the results and how do we begin to train managers and leaders to measure, again, performance in terms of the key results and not so much about the number of hours worked or the number of times you're there. Now, of course, there are certain industries and places where that's not as efficient. You're just not even possible to do that because, again, we need to be present in, and certainly healthcare is one of those areas. Service-related industries is another. Education to some extent, But again, even that's changing where, again, there's more online opportunities.
Yeah. I do think something is missed, though, when you're not going into the office and seeing your colleagues, just the general interaction and how ideas can come up just through discussion, again, depending on the job and the company. But if you're not in the office, you're not having that discussion. You're not inspired, creating new ideas or things like that. That's all lost, which I do think is a shame.
And I think we heard a lot of examples of that in the book when we were doing interviews, and companies, they recognize it too. So as they came back, they wanted to maintain the flexibility, but at the same time, they wanted that core opportunity to be able to come together as a team, as a group. And so sometimes that might have been one day a week. It might have been 2 days a week. Sometimes it was just creating core hours during the middle of the day, for example, on specific days of the week. The other one that was really important to some companies was really about the onboarding process. That, again, there was this early onboarding process where people were together as a group. And so they begin to, you know, understand the culture, see how things are really done, build the relationships. Also, there's things like it makes it a little bit easier as you begin to shift into career development too, and being able to do mentoring and other career developmental pieces of that along the way, as opposed to just starting off and being completely remote from the beginning.
Yeah. Well, it's a fascinating subject. And if people want to get a copy of the book, it's called Fair Share: How Men and Women Can Create a More Equitable Workplace Together. It's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's co-authored by David G. Smith, who we've been chatting with today. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.